Thank you so much. Good morning. It's wonderful to see you. Thank you so much, Dean O'Day, for that very kind and generous introduction, and for all you did and before you, Bill Leonard, to make me feel welcome here and to include me in this excellent experience that is known as Wake Forest University Divinity School. So Dean O'Day, Associate Dean Craneshaw, Provost Kirsch, faculty, staff, and students, it is my pleasure and honor today to bring you greetings from President Barack Obama. On a less formal note, let me also say that it's just great to be back here. First, I have to say how grateful I am to all of you for your support. I have received your notes and your voicemail messages, and while I haven't responded to all of you, and I apologize for that, things have been a little hectic, I want to take this opportunity to thank you. Your support has been so important to me. I know that you're praying for me, and I'm grateful for that. And just the knowledge that we share this bond and that we can renew it at times like this is incredibly meaningful to me. So thank you. Well, as Dean O'Day said, we come together today to mark the beginning of a new academic year. Some of you have just arrived at Wake Divinity, and you don't yet know the pleasures of Div School exams and term papers and Div School small group discussions and more small group discussions and more small group discussions. You're about to be introduced to all of that. And others of you are returning because of or in spite of those things. I'll let you put a label on that. All of you are preparing for a journey of the soul and the mind, the body and the spirit. And all of you have another thing in common. You have heard a call. You are here because you have been called to this place at this time for a particular purpose. For some, the way in which you will answer that call is already clear. You may be walking on a path that will take you towards serving in a church or serving as a chaplain, for example. For others, the call is clear, but the precise way in which you will answer that call has not yet come into focus. If that's true for you, fear not. You have a great cloud of witnesses here, and they will help you as you seek to bring that picture into better focus. This morning, I'd like to reflect on an element of a call that I see in operation every day in my new job. And that is a call that prompts some Americans, people of all faiths and none, to work with their government to serve people in need. Now, these joint efforts that I want to touch on today are not the most formal ones, ones supported by government grants and contracts. Indeed, most of the cases that I'll touch on today don't involve federal funding at all. Instead, they are partnerships between the government and community leaders that involve information sharing, convening, and strategizing to serve neighborhoods and communities. So I'd like to just tell you a few examples of some of the things that I get to witness and participate in every day. This summer, I visited Philadelphia, where religious and other community groups are partnering with the United States Department of Agriculture and city officials to operate what are called summer food service sites. Let me explain what that is. As you know, during the school year, many children receive free or subsidized meals. There's a problem when school is out. When school is out, these children might not have that nutritious midday meal, or even any nutritious meal. We obviously spotted that as a problem, and the government sought to solve that problem by working with community partners. So here's the policy and the practice that has developed. The USDA, again, the Department of Agriculture, pays for these meals in the summer, and then seeks partners to provide those meals, provide the site and activities for children in the summer so that they can receive these meals. So one of the organizations I visited in Philadelphia involves a partnership between a Catholic body and some sites of the Salvation Army working together with city officials to open the doors for neighborhood children during the day to come get this meal and to have activities. Well, seeing the kids pour through the doors and the smiles on their faces when they received a healthy meal and got to engage in these activities was truly moving. It was even more moving when I got to witness the longtime volunteers and meet some of the volunteers who have been doing this kind of service for years, often unnoticed and unheralded. So this is one of the ways in which faith and values work together to promote the common good. Earlier in the summer, I had the opportunity to work with faith and other community groups that are interested in helping children of incarcerated parents. Did you know that there are more than 2 million children in the United States who have a parent that is incarcerated? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that children of incarcerated parents are more likely to witness violence in their communities or households and to be exposed to drug and alcohol abuse. To help people identify and address this problem, the Department of Justice has launched a series of initiatives. One of those initiatives is a webinar that's produced for community leaders. And it helps people understand and identify this population of children and the specific risks that they may be subject to. It also provides resources for community leaders to know how to intervene in these situations and to help these children to have better lives, to assist their families and also their communities. Interestingly, the administration's work in this space has also included a partnership with Sesame Street Workshop, which has yielded the workshop's newest initiative called Little Children, Big Challenge. This initiative includes a guide for parents and caregivers, a new Sesame Street video, and more. Well, unsurprisingly, initiatives like these have attracted partners from the political and theological left and right. After all of us agree that every child is precious. All of us agree that every child richly deserves the opportunity to grow and thrive. Another example. After I leave here today, I'll be visiting with some leaders of the National Baptist Convention in Charlotte, where they're meeting. They're focused on an incredible number of important public challenges that face our nation as part of their worship and work year-round. One of their current focal points is ensuring that their networks are aware of and able to take advantage of the benefits provided by the Affordable Care Act, the health care reform law. 15% of Americans don't have health coverage right now, and many others have an adequate health insurance. Soon, they'll have some better options. Starting October 1 of this year, the new healthcare law will allow these people to purchase health insurance through a new online marketplace at healthcare.gov. For people with the lowest income levels, coverage will be free. Other low-income people will be eligible for subsidies to purchase health insurance. Now, we know that getting affordable, quality health care coverage can make a profound difference in people's lives. These people will no longer need to fear that their finances and their lives will be turned upside down by health care costs from an unexpected illness or an accident. Getting these people enrolled in health care will mean that they will have more productive, more peaceful lives, as well as just a more physically healthy life. Some congregational and civic networks have taken it upon themselves to spread the news about these benefits. They know that the fact that these benefits are available is not enough. People have to know that the benefits are available. They have to hear about it from people in their community. They have to be encouraged to access this coverage, and they have to know how to actually go about signing up. And this is exactly what many faith and other community leaders have decided to do. Well, all of these examples point to a larger lesson. Faith and community leaders and organizations often serve as connective tissue between the government and people in need. We are grateful for the work that they do. Now, at this point in my remarks, some of you, or maybe at least some of you who did not take the classes that Dr. Dunn and I taught, might have a question in your mind. You might say, well, this sounds appealing, but does it violate the constitutional command that requires church-state separation that we honor? And the answer is no. The state should never promote faith, either religion generally or one faith over another. And it should not prohibit the free exercise of religion. But the state can and should be in conversation with people of all faiths and none. And it can and should be willing to work with community organizations, whether they're faith-based or secular, to serve the common good. Of course, you all know that the public role of faith is not just demonstrated through partnerships that serve people in need. Religious bodies, communities, and leaders are among those that have shaped the laws and public policies of our nation, often leading our country to heed the better angels of its nature. And I'd like to close with a story about something else that I've been privileged to participate in recently in my work. We all know that we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington this past week, and we had so many events in the nation's capital in addition to the march and the commemorations. Worship services, service days, gatherings, discussions, workshops that were so meaningful to me and shined a light on what we have achieved and what remains to be done as we work together to perfect our nation. Part of those celebrations and commemorations was an observance that I'm sure many of you saw that happened on our National Mall on August 28th. And it and all the other surrounding activities were a powerful reminder of the historic role that certain coalitions of conscience have played in our nation's history. I would bet that many of you got to listen to some of the speeches that happened in front of the Lincoln Memorial, and you likely know that Congressman John Lewis was one of the speakers that day. He was also, as you know, one of the speakers at the original march. And in addition to serving in Congress, he also is a preacher. And I'd like to quote a bit from his remarks. Congressman Lewis said, "This moment in our history has been a long time coming, but a change has come. 50 years later, we can ride anywhere we want to ride. We can stay where we want to stay. Those signs that said white and colored are gone, and you won't see them anymore, except in a museum, in a book, or on a video. But there are still invisible signs," Congressman Lewis said, "buried in our hearts that form a gulf between us. Too many of us still believe our differences define us instead of the divine spark that runs through all human creation. And as the dean of the civil rights movement once said, we may have come here on different ships, but we're all in the same boat now. When we recognize that we're all in the same boat, we Americans have been able and will be able to accomplish remarkable things in our own country and around the world. America is blessed with people of all faiths and none, who believe that we must form coalitions of conscience to speak truth to power. And America is blessed with people of all faiths and none who believe that serving our neighbors is nothing less than a sacred or civic duty. I'm serving as a government official now, and it's certainly not my place to tell you how to interpret your faith or how to practice your faith. But it is my place to bear witness to this work and to invite you to consider it. For those who hear that call, we stand ready to work with you. Thank you.